I agree the problem is debt. The question is, how do you pay it back? What are the mechanisms? What are the methods? And who pays for it?
That's Mark Blythe, a political economist at Brown University and author of a forthcoming book called Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea. As you can tell from his accent, he hails from Great Britain, Scotland, actually, where they know something about national debt. Blythe says when he looks at all the countries around the world currently enacting austerity measures,
I see something which is superficially appealing, individually rational perhaps, and ultimately collectively disastrous. I don't deny the problem is debt over the past 20 or 30 years, both on our personal balance sheets as consumers and on our corporate balance sheets and on our state, national and local balance sheets. We've loaded up a lot of debt and we need to do something with it. But there's a problem. While it's individually rational for any, let's say, household to tighten its belt because their income stream's gone down, but if everyone does this at the same time, all that happens is you shrink the economy. And what's fascinating and disturbing at the moment is how this fallacious thought has grabbed the attention of the governing classes on a global level, on a state level, a national level, and on a local level. We cannot simultaneously all cut our way to prosperity. Someone needs to consume when someone is not consuming. Someone needs to export when someone is importing. We cannot all export at once. In Europe just now, we find this conversation based around austerity. We need to become more like the Germans. Well, we can't all be like the Germans because someone has to buy the BMWs.
But what about in a country like the United States? The economic recession hit everybody. I live in Wisconsin, which has a debt that everybody is talking about now. There are those who say it is a smaller debt than Illinois', for instance, or California's. Are you saying that each of us needs to take a different approach to debt?
The way I like to put it is this. I'm absolutely in favor of us all tightening our belts the minute we're all wearing the same pants. And we are not wearing the same pants. Whether it's across the income distribution, whether it's across the assets that we hold, we have very, very different balance sheet positions. If you're a single mom, if you're dependent upon working two jobs on minimum wage, your position in this recession is vastly different from someone who has $250,000 in assets and a mortgage which was paid off 5 years ago. So we're not all in the same position going into this.
What you're really talking about is something that we in the United States don't like to talk about very much, and that's class politics, isn't it?
You can use the phrase class politics, and in fact, I have done so. As you're probably guessing from my accent, I come from a country whereby you can say that and it's not considered a weird thing. But what we are talking about is a differential across the income distribution where those who basically made out the best in the past 10, 15 years of the financial boom are the ones who are not bearing the costs of the financial bust. So ordinary people at the bottom end of the income distribution, you can call them middle class, you can call them working class, whatever you want, are the ones whose incomes are relatively fixed, have not had great wage rises, if any real wage rises, when you take inflation into account over the past decade and a half or longer, are the ones who are stressed out in debt, are the ones whose jobs are much more fragile these days. And they're the ones who, first of all, have to pay for the bailouts in terms of the increase in government debt, which means at the local and national level, more interest payments, which means higher taxes or lesser spending. So they're doubly taxed, first of all, by paying for the bailouts, and secondly, by the lost growth. And then thirdly, by the consolidation that meant to come along afterwards to clean up the mess. Meanwhile, at the top of the income distribution, Jamie Dimon from Barclays has just got $6.8 million as a new bonus. Well, you know, things are nice at the top.
So I guess that doesn't help us come back to what the government should do about this. We can all complain about the people who have getting more and the people who don't have getting less. But what does that mean in terms of practical politics? What can you do on a government basis to try to raise everybody's boat?
There has to be some hard and consistent choices made from top to bottom. We are spending too much money relative to our tax take. If you're basically bringing in 19% of GDP in taxes and spending 30, you've got a problem. Somehow you're going to have to figure out a way to pay more taxes. Now, either that means top earners pay more, or it means you have a national value-added tax, or something else. And if you don't want to pay taxes, then simply give up trying to do certain things, like, for example, the fire department. Because things cost money. Roads cost money. Education costs money. The single most expensive discretionary item in the federal budget is Medicare D, prescription drugs for elderly people. If you're really serious about getting control of the budget, that needs to be cut. You can cut every single discretionary program apart from that one. You won't make a difference. So hard choices need to be made on taxes and spending. And simply skirting around the margins and pretending that by beating up on unions you'll produce a quarter of a million jobs is really just ridiculous.
You've looked at this on an international basis, and clearly the standard now is to go for an austerity budget. We're not seeing much of anybody who is pursuing stimulus spending, for instance. How can it be so clear to you and so completely unclear to the people in power?
It's a really interesting question. There are very strong electoral incentives for any Democratic politician to cut taxes. There are no incentives to raise them. You're out of a job. Nothing succeeds like success. We had 30 years of privatization, deregulation, treating your house as an ATM, credit cards, and the whole thing. And while there's a moral story that says people were living beyond their means, they were living beyond their means because they had no other means, because their wages were not growing relative to the costs of sending your kids to college and paying for your healthcare expenditures. So what we need to do is to rethink entirely, I think, from the ground up, what it is that we're trying to do with government and what it is we're trying to shelter and from what we're trying to shelter and where and why.
Is there enough money to pay for all of these things? Is it possible to balance cuts and taxes enough to stabilize the economy?
It's not a technical question. It's always a political question. I have a friend and colleague who occasionally teaches in Sweden, and he does a little experiment, which I do as well, which we stand in front of our students, maybe 100, 200 students, and we start off and we say, how many of you think that paying 90% taxes is crazy? And in Sweden, everyone thinks that's crazy. But once you get down to 70%, they begin to think it's reasonable. And basically, they settle around 60 or 50%. Why? Because they get a free, high-quality higher education, because healthcare is paid for by the state, because public transport isn't awful and called Amtrak, etc., etc. So if you have high-quality public goods, you're willing to pay for them because you get what you pay for. In the United States, I do the same thing. I start at the other end of the distribution and say, is 10% okay? And usually people settle on 20 to 30%, but aren't willing to go any higher than that. Why? Because they have an experience that a lot of them go to private school because the state-supplied school wasn't good enough. They invest and they save their money and they don't expect the state to do for them. And you end up with bad quality public goods, which are residualized and treated as welfare goods for people who can't afford private alternatives. In that society, raising taxes is very dangerous because everyone will say, why would you want to give it to the state? The state's awful. So the politics here are what mattered. It's not a question of an accounting gimmick. Is there enough money? Absolutely. The United States currently spends, I believe the figure is, 46% of all defense expenditures on the planet. That's a huge amount of money.
I'm stunned by that. I guess I want you to repeat that. 46%?
46. Either 46 or 43% of total defense expenditures worldwide. Now, you have to remember the United States is 20% of the global economy. So to pay for 46% of defense expenditures only takes up 5% of GDP. It's good to be big. But think what you could do with 1% of that GDP if you weren't spending it there and you were spending it on someone else. But then it becomes a question of, well, why should we spend it on something else? Because the United States, in part, is founded on a belief that people provide for themselves. That's efficient. Markets are good. The state is the last resort.
All right. Comes down to the last question, then. Austerity is the push right now, nationwide here, and in fact, worldwide. If growth is not going to be the result from the current policies, what do you think is going to happen?
Essentially a very long-term stagnation. You see this already in the way that we've accepted rather passively that unemployment in the United States is going to remain around 10, 9 or 8% into the foreseeable future. The great American jobs machine has ground to a halt, and it's going to start again, but not at the same rate. Where we see job growth being concentrated is in the low-wage sector, in the most flexible part of the labor market. So you're going to see greater income skewing over time. So what we get is a polarization of income and consequent polarization of politics. And if you have a party in charge that blames everything and anything on unions, even though they're less than 10% of all workers, and changing collective bargaining is somehow going to balance the budget, then we're into a very destructive cycle of blaming and a politics of blame attribution that really has no good end. And it's something that, frankly, I'm very worried about. I agree the problem is debt. The question is, how do you pay it back? What are the mechanisms? What are the methods? And who pays for it? How do you apportion not just blame but responsibility for fiscal sanity, rather than simply freaking out about debt numbers that make no sense in isolation and turning around and saying that everything the state does is always and everywhere bad? Because when you're doing that, you're talking about the fireman, the teacher, and the Medicaid prescription benefit that you rely upon.
Mark Blythe is a professor of international political economy at Brown University. He's a member of the Warwick Commission on International Financial Reform, and he's working on a new book called Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea. You can watch his short video about austerity on our website at ttbook.org.